The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Save big money on your entire roofing project now at Menards. Protect your home for years to come with Owens Corning Architectural Shingles. They offer long-lasting performance while providing ultimate protection with a 130 miles per hour wind rating and limited lifetime warranty. Choose from over 50 options of Owens Corning shingles in-store and on Menards.com. And check out more of our great deals going on now.
Save big money at Menards.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Today's episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra. At only 2.6 carbs and 95 calories, it's only worth it if you enjoy it. Stay tuned for the Ultra Moment of the Week, coming up later in the episode. All right, welcome on everyone to a playoff week 3 edition, a playoff losers week 3 edition of Hollinger and Duncan. Got much to discuss here. Obviously, we got to catch up on what's going on in the playoffs to date. And of course, we also got to check in on some of these teams and why they lost and where they potentially can go from here. John, would you like to be positive about the teams that are doing well, or negative about the teams that have already been eliminated, or negative about the teams that are trailing in their series? I will leave it to you here to pick to start.
Let's go negative, but not all the way negative, about the teams whose seasons have ended.
Okay. Who do you want to start with?
So it looks like the big story of the day is Indiana, actually.
Yeah, wow. That, with Nate Bjorkgren, they've moved on from it. It seems actually that is quite interconnected with maybe some of the other teams whose seasons have ended.
Certainly, yeah.
So far.
Yeah, yeah. It seems like, Terry Stotts and Steve Clifford are going to be candidates in Indiana, with Stotts' name being mentioned pretty prominently here. And then you also wonder, there is another team who is currently down 2-0 in their second round series, and you wonder if their coach would become a candidate too, if he were to become available, hypothetically.
Yeah, that's, well, by the way, I can assure you guys, you know, we had some problems at the start of the show, muting and unmuting, and it wasn't really working. We couldn't hear each other. It was probably annoying for the listener. I assure you that has nothing to do with the state of the roster on this podcast. It was all just bad coaching. It's nothing to do with me or John whatsoever.
That was some performance art, wasn't it? I actually wrote about that in The Athletic, that, you know, it came across badly. I also wonder what other choice he sort of had. Like, if your ultimate end game is you don't want Lillard demanding a trade, right? Like, that's your worst case scenario. So, and you're pretty much stuck with this roster at least next year for sure. So what else are you going to say?
Yeah, you could sort of have a little humility about it, maybe. I mean, but yeah. Neil O'Shea is not known for that. He is not known for, you know, really, he always is going to put the absolute best face on his own work in the media. For those who missed it, he said basically that their loss had nothing to do with the players on the roster. And, you know, it might be, might want to take a look at yourself in the mirror if you had your backup front court as Enes Kanter, who was so bad he couldn't even play in the playoffs, and Carmelo Anthony. I do agree that I think it was time for them to move on from Stotts. I think it just, I don't know if anyone can fix the defense, but it was clear that he couldn't. They do have some decent players.
Yeah, that's a fair way to put it. I mean, the one part where I sort of agreed with him was that they shouldn't have been 29th in defense. Like, they shouldn't have been that bad.
Yeah, and they were screwing up some basic stuff in that Denver series. Yes, Denver is very good. Yes, you didn't expect, you know, Austin Rivers to have 5 out of 10 3-point shooting shooting games, right? I mean, I think actually all four games that Denver won in that series, they shot well over 40% from three, like on good volume. I mean, that was in theory kind of the right strategy to make them bomb away. Like they weren't going to hit like that every game, but still, like they were just giving up very easy stuff on things like not helping off Facundo Campazzo when he sets a screen for Nikola Jokic,
yeah. You
know, because they're worried Campazzo is going to like, you know, pop out for a three-pointer or something. Like that was just not locked in enough on just like some of the principles and some of the core actions that Denver had, I thought. So yeah, I mean but what can they do is the question here to get better. And let me ask you this, like, do you feel like Portland, other than the defense, is like underperformed over the last few years from like a roster standpoint? Like, is there more that they should have realistically been doing?
I don't think so. Like, I didn't think their roster was that good heading into last year when Olshay famously proclaimed it, you know, the deepest, most talented team they've had since he's been there. And I just thought they massively overrated some of the guys that they had picked up at that point. And they didn't really change the roster that much heading into this year. Now, they had some injury issues, but like, I mean, Zach Collins isn't the difference between what happened this year and like making the conference finals. I mean, he's just not. And so, you know, and Lillard has been basically totally healthy and had the two best years of his career, and they've been kind of wasted.
So anybody that you like there for them?
That's why I think the coach is the only move on the board, because what else are they going to do?
From a coaching standpoint, then.
From a coaching standpoint, I would try to use Derek Jones Jr. as a five. I think they didn't really try that. They had the players they had. I thought they were maybe a little too deferential to Carmelo. He wasn't terrible this year. And like, if they hadn't been, would that have shifted them? You know, maybe they get one more win, right? Like, it just wasn't a needle moving decision either. And so,
yeah. Carmelo being like number two in the NBA in contested 2-point jumpers attempted might have been a little speculative there. But I mean, when I say from a coaching perspective, I mean, like, are there any coaches that are out there that you think would be a solid candidate there? I've got one. If you none come to mind for you,
all right. Who's your? I thought of one name, but who's your guy?
Mike D'Antoni. I think we've even talked about him before.
That's a good one. Yeah, because it's an offensive team. Not really switch talent for the defensive side, I would say. I mean, that's one of the things with having Lillard and McCollum is that you're sort of locked into playing a certain way, because switching probably isn't going to be as effective with them. But who knows? Maybe you can give it a try and see if it works. I mean, if they bring back Powell next year, like, that's, you're basically all in on offense with that, right? When you're talking about another smallish guy playing the three, you have one elite help defender, but you don't have anyone to like stop the ball in the first place.
Yeah, and they also have Nurkic, who they basically, whenever he's been off the floor, that's when they've been complete disasters defensively. So it's hard to switch with him as well. But offensively, I mean, I think just kind of leaning into that, just finding a way to make it a little easier for Lillard in the playoffs. You know, maybe D'Antoni can come up with some stuff from there. And also, I talked about this with Danny last night. I came up with a new term for this coaching situation. You know, when a player dribbles for 25 seconds and then, probably not 25 seconds, but 20 seconds, and then can't get an opening. And so he passes it to another teammate with five on the shot clock who doesn't have an opening. I call that a flaming bag. Like a flaming bag coaching situation where you basically got 1 year left to get it right, or your star might leave. There's all kinds of pressure. The expectations are probably unrealistically high. And so, man, like, if you're like a real up and coming coaching candidate with other options, like, do you want this job when you know that, like, basically, like, you have to succeed right away? You can't grow into the job, you can't try stuff out, you gotta just look awesome right away, or Dame Lillard might want to get traded at the trade deadline.
I would certainly put in a call to Steven Silas before I took it.
Oh yeah that was the ultimate flaming bag. Flaming bag of a job right there. Yeah, so I mean, but D'Antoni, like, his time horizon, he's kind of established. I don't think he's gonna have other options. He's 71, I think, so he's only going to probably coach for another 2-3 years at most anyway. So I kind of like that idea.
I like that idea, but when you come into a presser saying no matter what, you're going to hire a coach who can improve the defense, and that's the number one thing, I don't think you can turn around. Like, the optics on that are terrible.
Neil O'Shea doesn't care about the optics.
I think he cares a lot about the optics, actually. The guy I was going to mention was Steve Clifford.
Yeah, that's another interesting one as well. We've talked about Portland quite a bit here, John, and I think quite clearly Neil O'Shea saying the roster had nothing to do with their loss is the Michelob Ultra moment of the week. At only 2.6 carbs and 95 calories, it's only worth it if you enjoy it. I certainly enjoyed Neil's presser this time. Blazers fans, I think that moment could have been improved for you with a Michelob Ultra, but it is certainly my hope that Blazers fans will experience joy and happiness of seeing Dame Lillard in a Blazers uniform for years to come. At only 2.6 carbs and 95 calories, with Michelob Ultra, enjoyment isn't the end game, it's the whole game. Go check out tons of other exciting Ultra moments with the hashtag #UltraMoment. Credit Karma has always been there to help you make better financial decisions, and now they want to help even more. With a Credit Karma money spend account, you can be rewarded for good money habits. Credit Karma is a brand new checking account where you can win cash reimbursements for making purchases. Use your Credit Karma money debit card, and you can win daily Instant Karma purchase reimbursements on items up to $5,000. Just pay with your debit card, and if you win, you'll be notified on the spot, and your Instant Karma cash will be added back to your spend account. They've already given away over $3 million in Instant Karma to over 50,000 Credit Karma members and counting. Open your FDIC insured spend account for free. No minimum balance, no overdraft fees, and free withdrawals for a network of over 50,000 ATMs. And when you make a purchase between June 8th and June 30th, you'll automatically be entered to win $1 million. Right now, visit creditkarma.com/winmoney to open your free account and start winning Instant Karma. That's creditkarma.com/winmoney to sign up for free and start winning Instant Karma. That's creditkarma.com/winmoney. Instant Karma is sponsored by Credit Karma. No purchase necessary. Exclusions and terms apply. See rules. Banking services provided by MVB Bank Inc. Member FDIC. Maximum balance and transfer limits apply. I think the other team we got to talk about here is a team that probably has better hopes next year in the Western Conference, and that is the LA Lakers.
Yeah. You know, I think their supporting cast really let them down this year. I mean, when you go full mid-level for Montrezl Harrell and he doesn't even get on the floor, basically. Their biannual exception was Wes Matthews, who was basically a bit player. Went through Marc Gasol, Andre Drummond at the center spot after giving up draft equity to unload JaVale McGee. Like, at the end of the day, would their season have been any different with JaVale McGee than those guys?
No, I wouldn't think so. And so, you know, they had some issues with COVID. They had some issues with injuries. They were 21-6. With LeBron and Davis. You know, I mean, you would love it if they could just build their team around, I don't know, maybe some shooters around LeBron James and Anthony Davis. Like, is that just like too easy?
Like, right.
These guys to struggle offensively when you have LeBron and Anthony Davis because you're shooting 29% from three as a team on wide open looks in the playoffs, you know, like that's just not really acceptable. And, you know, KCP, I think, can kind of fit into that a little bit.
Yeah. They tried bringing in Ben McLemore, Wes Matthews, but I think they just needed to get like a notch higher of player than that.
Yeah, someone like Danny Green, maybe. Like Schroeder, you know, I think like the idea, it seemed like too much of their focus, and you can understand this, although I was on record as not liking their offseason moves at the time. So, I mean, people were like, oh, they made great moves. Everyone loved them. Like, I wasn't a fan of them to begin with. But I could at least understand the thinking, which was, hey, LeBron, AD, we just went off this run in the bubble. We got the shortest offseason ever. So what are we doing here? We got to, like, make things easier for these guys during the regular season, or they're going to burn out. As it turned out, they got injured anyway. But, Harrell and Schroeder, anybody with a brain would know that Montrezl Harrell playing next to Anthony Davis in the playoffs was just a complete non-starter. It was just never going to work. And Schroeder, you know, the idea was, all right, we need like one more creator, but then maybe that could have worked if you're like, all right, we're going to play Anthony Davis at center basically all the time in the playoffs, and we're going to have two great shooters in addition to LeBron and AD and Schroeder, you know, then maybe it would have worked because Schroeder would have had more space to attack, but he's not a good enough spot up shooter. And so, you know, they really just to have one guy on the roster where teams are like, no, we can't leave this dude.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be amazing. Now, you know, who is that going to be? What can they trade this offseason? I mean, they can trade their 2027 first rounder.
They can trade this year's first rounder on draft night.
That is correct too. Yeah, they can do that. So, you know, with that, they are probably going to be too close to the tax to do a sign and trade, though, to receive a player.
Yes.
In a sign and trade. You know, I mean, I think they would love to have like a Tim Hardaway Jr., but I think I don't know how it is that they get that guy.
I agree with that. And, you know, even to just run it back is going to end up putting them roughly $30 million into the tax, which is like $100 million check to the league. I mean, even for the Lakers, that's a tough pill to swallow. So I think there's a lot of questions just about how this team is built and how they try to redo it.
They might have to dip into that PPP loan they applied for.
I think Harrell opting out might do him a favor if that happens.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Would you, if you could just take Harrell and you're one of these center needy teams, because the center market is just atrocious this year for free agents. Would you just take Harrell if he opts in, if you were another team? Like, is there any team that, like, if you're Charlotte or something, like, you got some cap space, would you just take him for $9 million?
Yeah, like, especially if I'm one of those teams where I'm not thinking about June. I'm thinking about getting to the point where I can play a game in May. Like, yeah, I'm gonna probably take him, especially at that number. Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, James Borrego has shown a good ability to kind of hide bad defenders in the zone. Ultimately, that adds up. But, I mean, having like a dominant role man, although fair to question perhaps whether Harrell is that still, but to pair with Devontae Graham, who they'll presumably bring back, and Rozier, and obviously LaMelo. Yeah. I almost said Lonzo. It's so funny how I stop thinking about all these other teams. Like, when you get into like this point in the playoffs and you're seeing like how high level this is and like how, you know, only six guys can stay on the floor in that Clippers-Dallas series, like, it's just such a step down thinking about these teams that didn't even make the playoffs, and it's like they just feel completely irrelevant. You're like, these teams are so far away from even being able to think about being in the position that we're watching teams in right now.
Right. Like, what is Cleveland's five-man lineup look like in this series, right?
So anyway, a trade of Harrell just to open up the space, I think would be pretty good for them. But then obviously you run into the question of these free agents with Horton Tucker, Caruso, and of course, Dennis Schroeder. What do you think happens there? Let me change up actually. How would you handle that now as the Lakers general manager?
So I think it's a very tricky area there. And the first thing I'm trying to do is pair a contract with my first round pick, 22nd overall, to see if I can get a significant talent upgrade to a player who is already under contract. And that's still going to be tough. But I think the trade market this year is going to be very active just because the free agent market is so lame. And so I would look very hard at that if I was the Lakers first. I wrote about something last year called the Bird Rights Trap, which basically means with a player like Dennis Schroeder, if you don't re-sign him, you cannot replace him because you are too close. You're over the cap. You only have the mid-level exception. You're just not going to get somebody as good. So in their situation where you're basically, I mean, you have to come in with the mindset that you're all in for right now. LeBron James is 37 or whatever. Like, you're, and Anthony Davis, to be honest, has been pretty brittle, even though he's younger. So I think you have to operate with that mindset. I do think you want to re-sign Horton Tucker. I think other teams are going to drop offer sheets that make that a test of wills, let's say, for the Lakers. So that's going to get really interesting. You could, you know, if there's a way to get assets for you that work in another trade, you could go ahead and sign and trade him. And that may be the best way to organize your payroll if it gets you something out of it. But like people talked about the Kyle Lowry move they didn't make because they didn't want to give up Horton Tucker. But the thing is, like, they have a hard time signing Kyle Lowry now because they don't have his bird rights and they can't do a sign and trade for him. So they're basically looking at their best option would be if Montrezl Harrell opted out, they probably have enough wiggle room to sign him with their full mid-level exception if Lowry was willing to pay for that little. And that's kind of it, right?
Yeah, and I wouldn't be. I mean, well, he specifically said in his presser leaving Toronto, money in years talk. So
yeah,
that's not a very loud voice.
Yeah, and they will talk louder in Miami, let's say. So
yeah.
So yeah, well, so
this is yeah, go ahead, sorry.
It's going to be really hard. Basically, this is a difficult offseason coming for the Lakers. They are going to have to find talent in non-obvious places and, you know, make some deals with their assets that just reshape this pie differently so that the pieces fit. It's going to be a challenge. One guy I do think the Lakers maybe should look at who can opt out of his minimum deal is Bryn Forbes from Milwaukee.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. It's kind of coming more into focus for me now that this AD not playing center thing totally screws them up because it's not possible to get enough shooting on the floor. AD is like, you know, probably a below average shooter for a four in today's day and age, and obviously yeah. You don't want him just like hanging out by the three-point line. You're gonna mm-hmm. have some center who can't shoot mm-hmm. and then LeBron, you want the ball to be in his hands, and so now but you also don't want LeBron to be the only ball handler, right? They kind of got past that when LeBron was averaging 10 assists in 1920, but they don't want to put that burden on him and have him be the only guy who can attack off the dribble on the whole team. So now you're going to also have to have a point guard. Point guards who can drive to the basket and create probably aren't going to be great shooters either. And so now you've basically got one position to put a shooter at. If you just put AD at center, now he's a plus shooter at the five. You can put in another guy who can shoot at the four or play LeBron there, even though he doesn't want to play the four. And so, yeah, I mean, I understand maybe you could start with the center, but you definitely don't want to put any resources in other than just the pure minimum for these centers. Just and in the playoffs, like, you just got to play AD at center for 35 minutes a game, or you're just not going to be able to score well enough. And they kind of, for whatever reason, all these guys hit shots in the bubble, which was not what they did during the regular season last year. And it's not what they
including
did this year.
AD.
Yeah, yeah. AD was 40% for three and like 50% for mid-range in the bubble. So, yeah, but Brad says, can AD's body handle playing the five? I'm not really sure, like, what that means, right? Like, what is causing him to be injured playing the five? Like, it's not like, you know, I mean, maybe some of this like shoulder stuff or whatever, but I mean, if you want to win it, that's just the only way to do it. And you got to just hope that he holds up in the playoffs. During the regular season, sure, you know, plan on playing AD at center 20 minutes a game. He held up just fine in 2018 in that the one year that they were good in New Orleans, and he had a stretch five or four next to him with Mirotic. But it messes up the structure of their offense so much to not have him playing the five if you're also going to have LeBron, and then you also got to have another guy who can dribble as well and probably isn't going to be able to shoot.
Yeah, so I think they have to rethink a lot. And, you know, the one guy who could potentially be a shot creator off the dribble was Kuzma. And, you know, he had a good start to his year, and I think he kind of got lost as the year went on.
I mean, I don't think you can afford him at $13 million. I think you got to just move on from him at this point.
Yeah, because you're paying him to be a backup four. I think you have to hope that somebody else likes him and that, you know, you're almost like that extension was almost done with the idea of having a trade ship, maybe, or maybe it wasn't, but now you look at it that way that, okay, can he be the guy who gets us the guy?
Yeah. So yeah, it's going to be an interesting offseason for the Lakers. Any more of these postmortems you wanted to do, or should we talk about what's happened here in the playoffs?
I think we got to talk about Dallas.
Yes. Another fascinating one. And it's so weird to think of, hey, Luka's only 22. He's about to sign a Supermax extension, and to wonder like what their path forward is nonetheless.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because the conversation with, oh, Dallas will have max cap space, that assumed that Josh Richardson would opt out, which I don't really see happening anymore.
Yeah, $11 million player option for him. So if he opts in, they're down to $23 million in space.
Yeah, yeah. And so, and that's without Hardaway, obviously, who played well enough that I think you probably want to bring him back because he showed he does fit. They don't really have they don't have any draft equity because of the Porzingis deal, so they can't make deals that way. And Porzingis, I think, I mean, they got to figure out a way to activate him, right? He can't just be a very tall shooting guard, right? And there has to be some way to make him a bigger part of the picture. And I think that the other place Dallas hurts themselves is Luka is so comfortable playing on the ball and is so good on it that they don't really cultivate other options. But what happens is you can see it. I mean, you can see it within games and you can see it in the regular season. And you see it, especially in the playoffs, that by the fourth quarter, he just doesn't have the same juice doing that. And, you know, if you can do more to lessen his strain in the first three quarters, I mean, because to me, you either have to cut him back to 34 minutes a game in the playoffs, or you have to figure out a way to have Jalen Brunson or somebody else be like the lead ball handler while Luka is also on the floor and let him just take a break every now and then.
I agree with you that that's a huge concern. And I also think that if they had just had a different matchup in the playoffs these last 2 years, like the Clippers are a really difficult matchup for them with the wing defenders that they have and that they can just switch everything. So that really takes Porzingis out of his pick and pop game. You know, we might be feeling totally differently about them if they were just playing against a team that had a traditional center. Because it's also, you know, if Luka can just play pick and roll, it's much easier for him. If he's got to go one-on-one all the time against a switch, like, he is going to wear down. And Brunson is way less effective that way also. So
all these playoff defenses, like, whoever draws Dallas is going to be switching those pick and rolls in the playoffs.
Well, like, Utah wouldn't. I don't think that Phoenix would. But yeah, I mean, the best teams are going to be able to have that defensive versatility. I mean, that's been a principle that we've seen very clearly over the last 5 years. So I agree with you there. But also, like, the offense wasn't the problem in that series. Like, they couldn't stop anybody. I mean, that to me is the bigger structural issue that they have. And Porzingis, in addition to getting injured, like, he's probably too slow. You know, he's going to have to play conventional pick and roll defense. He doesn't have the scheme versatility. So, I mean, as crazy as it is to say, Luka signs that extension. I mean, he obviously wants to put some pressure on them, but I think I would just, you know, you already know where this road leads with Porzingis and Tim Hardaway Jr., who also is not that good defensively. Mm-hmm. Tim Hardaway Jr. is pretty good. Hey, we can't take a step back, blah, blah, blah. You want to spend $80 million on this dude at age 29? Like, where are you going with that if you do that? And same thing, you know, you've got $30 million to Porzingis. So you think you're going to pay Tim Hardaway Jr. like your third best player and Porzingis like your second best player? Like, you can't win that way. I don't care who your number one is. So I think you have to not be in that situation. And now, who is the other second star that you're going to get? I mean, I have no idea. Maybe it's cap space in 2022, which they're not currently slated to have because Luka's extension is going to kick in, you know, but maybe it's just moving on from Porzingis at that point, or trying to do that now, even, right? Maybe you should do that now. You know, like, so let me ask you this. Like, if you could just, let's say you could just trade Kristaps Porzingis into San Antonio's cap space and get something, you know, nominal back so you don't take the PR hit as much. Would you do that? Just get rid of him?
Wow. You might.
I mean, like, it's scary, right? Like, I think you probably have a lower chance of, like, you're probably going to take a step back next year.
Yeah.
And maybe you never even get somebody as good as Porzingis. But I think Luka is that good. You still got some decent low-salaried role players. You know, like, is not having Porzingis really going to kill you next year? And you can find a decent, you know, you mentioned, like, Bryn Forbes. You find, like, a decent Hardaway Jr. facsimile for next year. Like, well,
You also can still re-sign Hardaway.
And just move him later, potentially.
Or just, you know, what if you did, you know, 1 year, $30 million or something?
Yeah. I mean, maybe that's what it is as well. You know, I assume he'd want to have something longer term. But yeah, I think that's, you know, or maybe they can try the John Collins route. You know, Collins is a little more versatility defensively, but still probably not enough.
That's a good one, actually. I actually like that one because he could be a roll man or a pop man. And he definitely has more scheme versatility than Porzingis at this point. The other one I was going to ask you about, because I see Lillard and Doncic being in kind of the same boat, where they are both elite, elite offensive players who basically assure you're going to have a top-notch offense just by their presence.
Yeah.
But they don't really, they don't move the needle for you on defense at all, which is in contrast to a lot of other superstar players. And so you need more defensive heft around them, for that reason. I think that's a structural obstacle that both Dallas and Portland face with their teams. And I'm not sure if this is just trading potato for potato, but I was wondering about Kristaps Porzingis for CJ McCollum.
Yeah, that came up actually on our locker room yesterday, me and Danny. I ultimately don't think I would do that if I were Dallas. Because again, you're just locking into something that is just, it's not going to get you there. You know it's not going to get you there. Like, it might be an incremental improvement over the next year or two. It might not be with CJ. But like, your defense isn't going to get any better if you've got Doncic and McCollum out there. And, you know, I think I would do that as Portland, I think. And then I guess you would try to move Nurkic to see if you could get some wing help, although, you know, trading a big for a wing, good luck with that in today's NBA.
yeah that's,
but I do think like the pick and pop game of Porzingis would be pretty good with Lillard. So I don't think it moves the needle for either team, but I probably prefer that as Portland. I mean do you agree with me that getting a CJ is just like, all right, that's kind of nice, but like, is he really, as your second best player, is that getting you there?
I think both teams are basically still in the same place after the trade. It's just it's rearranging deck furniture, right? Yeah.
But you're also trading young for old.
Yeah, you know? I think that's where I end up on that.
And CJ has another year, actually. They both have, they both have 3 years.
You say young for old, but I think there's a decent chance CJ ends up playing longer than Porzingis does.
Yeah, although Porzingis has at least the possibility of continuing to improve, which I don't think CJ does. So, it's all about possibilities here, I think. And, you know, I think there's a reasonable argument that, hey, we don't want to trade Porzingis now. He's at his nadir year. But if he suffers another injury, then you can't even move him for nothing.
Yeah, you're sitting on dead money at that point.
Yeah. That
Spurs idea is interesting.
Yeah. I mean, now I would, how about this one? What if you offered Porzingis and a first round pick for like Derek White, assuming White is healthy now with this toe and an ankle thing, or one of these other, you know, or Keldon Johnson, one of these other like young Spurs guys?
Do any of them really change anything for you? I mean, Derek White, maybe, I guess.
Yeah. Well, he makes little enough money.
His contract is not bad. Yeah. So you probably could live with that. Like, I don't think DeJounte quite fits.
No, he doesn't.
Vassell is probably a little too speculative to do that. Derek White would be the one. And he's the one who maybe doesn't quite fit as well with what San Antonio was doing either, because he's older than these other guys.
Yeah. Like, Porzingis isn't that much younger than him. But, I mean, I could see the Spurs just being like, ooh, foreign big. Like, you know, we really want this guy. I mean, I don't know that Porzingis, from an attitude perspective, is necessarily a Spurs guy.
Yeah,
he's had some foibles there, but
yeah.
I'm not sure what they do at this point, which is crazy to think about. You have this 22-year-old superstar that, you know, is this going to turn into LeBron James in Cleveland 2.0?
Yeah, you definitely wonder about that. Does that mean Porzingis is Larry Hughes?
I mean, I do think
he hasn't fallen that far. Let's back off.
No, he has not fallen that far. Today on the road to the finals, our NBA playoffs coverage is brought to you by Michelob Ultra. It's only worth it if you enjoy it. And at 2.6 carbs and 95 calories, we can all enjoy the games a little bit more this season. Let's talk about what's going on here in the latter half of the first round and then in round two here. And obviously, another team that is, I mean, this has just been shocking to me how bad the Milwaukee Bucks have looked. As much credit as I want to give to Brooklyn and Kevin Durant looking like the best player in the NBA again, which is just an amazing story that I'm incredibly happy about. Man, like, I mean, how can the Bucks be this bad? How are they struggling this badly to score after two games?
It's so bewildering because the Nets are set up to beat you with offense, right? They're not set up to be a dominant defensive team. They're set up to, okay, we're going to do our switching and it'll be okay enough and we'll get a few stops and then we'll you know, you won't be able to stop us, and that's how we'll win. And Milwaukee's just scratching their, you know, after Boston. I mean, Boston with one guy was basically getting mostly what they wanted offensively against this team, and the Bucks are scratching their head like, how do we beat these guys? I do think they got to get Giannis off the ball. I think that's where it starts. I think he can be so much more threatening against, especially against those lineups Brooklyn has out there, as you know, screening, rolling, doing that kind of stuff. So I would start there. I think Chris Middleton just has to play better. And you know, you have to trust that he'll come around at some point. I mean, he was good last round. Yeah. He's been a good player his whole career. He's just not been good here. But it's shocking. I mean, their one sort of effective ruse has been Brook Lopez in the post, but I just don't think you're ever going to score enough that way to play that as your main offense.
No, particularly because Brook is never, ever, ever going to pass the ball.
He's actually thrown it out a couple times in this series, which has like been shocking.
I had already turned off that game by the time I think he did that in game two. But I think actually, like, Holiday had some pointed questions or pointed comments in the media afterwards of like, hey, we got to get it into the paint and then kick it out. And there's one play where Brook went into like four guys and both Holiday and Middleton were standing at the 3-point line with their arms up. And so maybe someone had to talk with him. Maybe someone had to talk with him after that. And that's why he started passing. But like, you can't just become a good passer. Like, you have to actually see those reads. Like, to actually make the decision of like, all right, I'm taking what the defense is giving me. I'm not open here. If he recognized that, then he would have been a better passer already. Like, you can't just flip a switch on something like that. It takes years of practice.
Yeah, I agree with that. Game one, I thought there was a lot of Jeff Teague happening.
Yeah, they at least adjusted and didn't play him during the competitive portion of the game, i.e. the first 5 minutes of game two. But I think they've got some real structural problems defensively. And I think missing DiVincenzo is part of that. But the Brook Lopez thing, like, you know, they might be able to outscore Brooklyn in some of these games. Like, Brooklyn's defense has been much worse on the road. It's been really good actually at home, even against the Celtics it was, but they got lit up on the road. Although the Bucks don't really have a player as good as Jason Tatum, it seems like, offensively. And so the Bucks will score better, I think, particularly at home. Like, they can probably win some games in this series, though obviously if they win game three, then they're just done. But there's no way that they can slow down the Nets offense, it seems like, to win four out of the next five games. Like, it's just because Brook Lopez is in a drop, they're killing that with Harris coming off screens, with KD in pick and roll, with Kyrie in pick and roll, with Mike James in pick and roll. So there's that structural issue. And then you take Lopez off the floor. Well, like, Giannis is getting cooked. PJ Tucker is getting cooked. Those are like your good defenders on KD. If you're going to switch, then you're going to be in even worse position and you're going to have no help at the rim. I mean, I kind of like the Nets strategy of going right at Antetokounmpo at every opportunity. And it's worked great. Like, both Kyrie and KD have really sized him up and challenged his ability to move laterally. And he hasn't been able to do it, which has been really surprising to me. So I just don't know how the Bucks, with their personnel, can fix this well enough to win four out of the next five games.
Do you dare to play zone against this Brooklyn team?
They tried it a little bit. They tried it a little bit in the start of game two. I mean, maybe you go for a box and one on KD, but you still got Harris and you got Kyrie out there, right? I mean, it's just, and KD is like the greatest zone buster in NBA history. If you have a guard just in his position in the zone, like, he's just going to be able to shoot over that guy in a closeout every single time. So you might just throw him off a rhythm a little bit, and just like, you know, they're not moving the ball, they're just getting their shots in a little different ways than they'd expect, maybe. But and you're still going to be giving up wide open threes, which these guys are pretty good, though, as it turns out.
The thing about these Nets, you give Steve Nash a lot of credit and give these three all-stars a lot of credit, that as good as they are individually, and they can play your turn, my turn sometimes, but when the situation calls for it, they move it, and that makes it so much harder to play against them and defeat them, because they don't get sucked into just going one-on-one over and over again. And that activates these secondary players. You know, we saw Blake Griffin, obviously, but even Bruce Brown, Landry Shamet, like these guys are able to eat, basically, because those three stars are willing to move off the ball.
And this, I don't know if this version of Kevin Durant is better than the Warriors version or the OKC version, but he certainly is in by far the best position to succeed. And you might think, oh, that's best position to succeed. And you might think, oh, that's crazy. Like, how can you say that he's playing with Steph Curry and Klay Thompson and Andre Iguodala, who were both relatively non-threats, or he was playing with a center who couldn't shoot at all on those Warriors teams. And so he didn't really, like, even in like that Houston series, for example, like they didn't just put Kevin Durant in high pick and roll and let him go to work with a ton of shooting around him. Obviously, OKC couldn't do that either, or just let him isolate against the other team's defender. Like, because I was like, oh, PJ Tucker, like, he did a pretty good job on KD back in that 2018 series against Houston. Well, yeah, they had all these non-shooters on the Warriors then. It was basically just Steph and Klay were the only other shooters on the team. Now they're shooting at basically every position, except for maybe one. And even Bruce Brown, you know, he's so quick that he can kind of, putting your center on him is, he's actually like able to beat that guy or flip the angle of the screen and get KD open. So this is Kevin Durant with this type of space. We've never seen that. And this is, there's no way to deal with it whatsoever if he's playing like this.
And then offensively, I mean, PJ Tucker is a total zero on offense now. And
yeah.
So if you're going to start him and he's going to get cooked like this, like, I think you just have to go in a different direction. Like, you have to start Connaughton or do something different, because you have to at least score enough to be viable in this game. And right now they're just not.
Yeah, I mean, to just accept the fact that you're not going to stop them and just go more often. But they just, like, they don't have the depth. They don't really have another way to play. And, you know, losing DiVincenzo really helped there, of like their one other guard other than Holiday who could shoot and was also competent defensively. So I don't really know what they can turn to. I mean, I think they should try switching. I don't think it's going to work, but nothing else has either. But they really only have like literally one 5-man lineup that can switch. So that's a problem.
Yeah, and that, I mean, this was the danger in what they did in the offseason, was that it left them with a really top-heavy roster, and that's why the injury to DiVincenzo hurts so much, is because when you only have 7 guys you would trust in a playoff series, when you lose one of them, it really hurts.
Yeah, and, you know, Bobby Portis would give him some more offense, but he's going to get cooked on defense as well. Yeah, but you're right. I mean, it's really hard to play PJ Tucker, Giannis, Brooke Lopez. Like, they really only have one shooter, that's Middleton. You know, Holiday, like, will shoot, and he's not, you're not going to just leave him, but he's also not, like, you know, a guy where you're like, oh man, we can't leave this guy. Like, you'll do it if you have to.
Yeah, same with Connaughton.
Yeah, so I think they're in trouble. I mean, it seemed like a 5-game series, barring, you know, some big change with injuries or whatever. Well, you don't need me to tell you about why Locker Room is such an awesome platform. You're hearing it on this pod. You can jump in. You can ask your questions. You can converse. You can make fun of us. Whatever you want to do. The app is free to download. Once you're in, talk with me, other fans, athletes, and insiders in real time about your favorite team, your favorite sport. John and I host our Locker Room each week on Wednesdays, generally 2 Eastern, 11 Pacific. Also do another Locker Room with Danny LaRue at 6 Eastern, 3 Pacific on Tuesdays. That's an hour-long one of just questions, so you can jump in there. So definitely download that free Locker Room app now. It's currently available on all iOS devices. They have a beta on Android. You create a profile, you link your Twitter, and you join the NBA group for the latest updates. You can follow me at NateDuncanNBA or Danny at DannyLaRue, be notified when our rooms go live. Locker Room is just a really fun technology, and hope to see you in our rooms next week. Do you know that 85% of people who play daily fantasy sports lose? Is it really that surprising? The game's rigged against you. You're playing against thousands of other lineups, not to mention experts who have more tools and more time. You don't stand a chance. That's why there's Stat Hero. It is the first ever daily fantasy sports book that puts the player in control and winning within reach. Here's how it works. Stat Hero actually shows you their lineups and dares you to beat them. It's you versus the house in a head-to-head fantasy matchup. You name your stakes, and it's winner take all. You have the advantage. Stat Hero is showing you their lineups ahead of time. No one else does that. So this is DFS the way it was meant to be, one-on-one. Play Stat Hero now and change the odds. Go to stathero.com/lockedon, sign up for free, and right now you can get 3x back on your first play. They're giving you a 300% match. That's unheard of. Go to stathero.com/lockedon. That's stathero.com/lockedon. Anything else that stood out to you that you want to talk about from this last week or so of playoffs?
Do you want to talk about Memphis at all?
Yes, of course. I actually I do want to talk about Memphis.
I think it's pretty interesting where they go from here.
Yeah. We talked about that a little bit last week, but anything you wanted to add? I think the they're actually going to have $20 million in cap space now because, I mean, there's no way that they hold on to Justice Winslow, right?
They are fronting like they might.
Just because the idea is he wasn't fully healthy and he needs more time.
I think, no, the idea is that somebody might want to trade for him between now and when they have to make the decision. Or that they could make a trade involving his salary. I think that's more the idea.
That team might want to just sign him for the minimum instead
if there's a deal for Memphis that is like Justice Winslow plus a 17th pick for a starter caliber player, they probably do that, right?
I guess they don't. You make a good point. There isn't really any other matching salary that they have, right? Like, it's pretty amazing. If you look at their salary sheet for next year, Winslow, if he opts into or if they opt him in, he's their second highest paid player. They got Valanciunas at 14 as their highest paid player and Brooks at 12. So, yeah, they really, I mean, and Kyle Anderson, they want to hold on to him. Tyus Jones would be the other one they could maybe move, but he still is their backup point guard.
I could easily see them moving off of Jones, especially if they draft a point guard at 17. Yeah, because I don't think you're going to pay your backup one that kind of salary going forward, especially when it's a small guy who can't really play at the same time as Ja Morant. So I think, you know, somebody more in like the George Hill space where it's a combo, I think you could talk yourself into a lot more. I think it's, you know, they're looking at kind of a consolidation year in some ways because they have basically like 13 rotation caliber players who they can't pay all of them going forward. So like at some point in the 2 years between now and when Ja Morant is making a max and Jaren Jackson is likely making significantly more money, and you know, some of these other guys are probably going to get paid too, like there's going to be some consolidation of this rotation. And can they figure out a way to trade some of these red chips for blue chips? You know, like almost like a 4-for-1 trade would be amazing for Memphis.
Good luck.
Exactly.
I mean, there's, you know, I don't think anybody is doing Tim Perry, Jeff Hornacek and Andrew Lang for Charles Barkley anymore, or whatever. I don't know if Lang was the third guy, but yeah, I don't think teams are doing that deal anymore. You know, it's what do you think they need? That's the biggest question. I mean, they have
the other reason they might consider picking up this Winslow option, as crazy as it sounds, is because they do need another big forward, and the market for big forwards this summer is absolute crap. So if they can't trade for one or draft one or come into one in some other ways, keeping Winslow for one more year at 13 and having him be an expiring might not be the worst thing. Now that's only the case though if you have no cap room aspirations. In other words, if you're already predetermined that you're not going to sign anybody this summer.
Yeah, the other thing too is they don't necessarily need matching salary to send back with Justice Winslow because they just have cap space. They could just take someone into their cap space.
And I would argue that might be the best move for them this summer, is that some teams will be looking to dump money and they could do a redux of their Iguodala deal and get more assets. I mean, they have 14 players signed for next season. That's insane. You never see that.
Yeah. That would include, yeah, with Winslow and then if the draft
with Winslow and Chante Porter. Like, I don't think Chante Porter is going to be back next year, but even if, you know, if they just roster their two draft picks, they're at 15 before they do anything in free agency.
Yeah, I mean, maybe you just hold on to Winslow because they definitely, in that Utah series, they really could have used his defense because they were just in this situation where they just didn't, when Conley and Mitchell were out there together, Ja Morant had to guard one of those guys and they were screwed.
Yeah, and they also were playing six, like they would have to put, anytime Anderson went out, they ended up with Dylan Brooks playing four with 2 6-4 shooting guards. So they had to take Brooks off of Mitchell and put him on Bogdanović because otherwise Bogdanović was going to mash one of the other guys. And so they were just playing whack-a-mole on perimeter, even beyond the fact that they were putting Valanciunas in pick and roll and all the other leaks they were springing. Just the ability to match up without another big wing on the roster was really hard for them.
If you're really thinking about a serious team in Memphis that's going to actually contend, like, I think Ja Morant can be good enough for that. Jaren Jackson remains to be seen, obviously, particularly defensively, but you're kind of, you're in on him. You're hoping that he's going to develop well. But they need, as of right now, three things, right? They need another wing defender. And this goes hand in hand with that you really can't have Valanciunas be your main guy in the playoffs defensively. Like, you're not going to be able to stop teams with him. They've reached, like, I think Utah proved that very clearly. And then you also need another perimeter guy. You know, I don't think Dylan Brooks as your second perimeter guy is getting you where you need to be either. So they still have a lot of things on the wish list. And maybe this ends up with them topping out as kind of a second round playoff team because they just structurally can't get to where you need to be, you know, from both the multiple angles of attack and shooting offensively and defensive versatility. Maybe you just can't get there, but that's where you want to be. If you got to get there if you're gonna be a championship contender.
Yeah, and if you're not one of these teams that has LeBron James or Kevin Durant fall in your lap in free agency, it turns out it's really hard. So it's definitely gonna be a challenge for them. I agree with you though. Like, I think the best version of them when they look 2 years out in a playoff series is with Jaren Jackson as a five and maybe somebody at the four who complements him in terms of like being maybe a plus rebounder. And then Valanciunas probably more situational / regular season five.
Yeah. Or, I mean, his contract expires after next year too. So, all right, let's do some quick playoff awards here.
Ooh, okay.
Who's your... So far,
I would probably say Kawhi Leonard. I think he's really been spectacular. Although, I mean, KD has it's hard for me to argue strenuously for KD because they haven't had to play in competitive enough series for me to really be like, oh, KD is taking over. He's been the player of the second round.
Certainly.
He's been awesome. Yeah. But I just like Kawhi and that that was the guy who won the championship for Toronto, right? Where you're like, oh my goodness, this guy's just in complete, you know, locked in robot mode, or he's just.
You could even argue he was better because he is guarding Luka, which is a lot easier or a lot harder than guarding Giannis. That Kawhi was kind of, a little slow and kind of not really himself defensively. Like this Kawhi was crazy. He's making help plays. He's guarding Luka. I mean, I would say it's still him because I wouldn't, just let game one last night against Utah, which, that wasn't too good. We'll talk about that in a second, but, for just the Clippers overall, he's had a couple of stinkers, but yeah, I mean, I think overall the value has been the highest, but he and KD are looking like the two best guys in the league right now. We'll see how the rest of this series goes against Utah, obviously, for Kawhi.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a really interesting test. And then, Donovan Mitchell's look great too. I mean, he really won that game for Utah yesterday, especially not having Conley. And that was the question, was whether Utah could score one-on-one, and they were able to, at least for one game.
Well, I would push back on that because they weren't actually going one-on-one. The reason I liked the Clippers in that series was that they could space out the other Gobert on offense and that they could switch everything on defense. And then they played Luke Kennard because they wouldn't switch Kennard, right? Like,
that's true.
So he's just turning the corner in pick and roll and just getting right to the rim. And granted, they were tired, but I really thought, I don't know what happened to Nick Batum. I mean, maybe he was just tired, but to only play him 21 minutes. It's like he looked fine when he was out there, so I didn't really get that.
I did wonder if that was strategic. He played, I want to say, 81 minutes in the last two games of that Dallas series. There's definite, so when we did this show last week, I said in a hypothetical Clippers-Utah matchup, I would probably take the Clippers. And I switched when I wrote my preview for The Athletic because the Clippers coming off that seven-game series, Utah is set up to win the battle of attrition now. Mike Conley being out is another little wrinkle that I hadn't expected, so we'll see how that part plays out. But I do think the fatigue element for Utah is going to be very real. There are no extra off days this entire series. It's just every other, the whole way. And they're playing at elevation four times. I just wonder how much the Clippers' best players are going to have in the tank. This is going to be a really interesting problem for Ty Lue to manage, especially if this is a long series, which I think it probably ends up being.
Yeah. That said, they still could have won last night. And with Conley out, maybe they should have pushed a little harder just in terms of the personnel they were playing. I mean, I understood not playing guys as many minutes. I think that I understood why they did that. And it is kind of shaping up to be a long series. But that leading by 13 at halftime with no Mike Conley to just, and then Rondo was so bad. And I loved how Ty Lue went away from him in the Dallas series when he was killing them.
Yeah.
And he just didn't see that he was killing them last night. Like their offense, they weren't guarding him at all. He couldn't do anything.
Yeah, that was really bad. And they kind of forgot about Mann and all of that. Like, even if you're going to rest Batum, the Terrence Mann was perfectly capable of playing, right?
Yeah, I agree with you. So yeah, I mean that was and to not really like switch up what they were doing defensively against Mitchell in the fourth quarter. I mean, they're just like, he's getting downhill, getting right to the basket every single time. It was just rinse repeat with two high screens involving Kennard, and then you just split it or turn the corner and get right to the rim to his right hand every single time. Let's see here. What else do we... Oh, I mean, so who's your pick now for the championship? We do this every week.
I think it has to be Brooklyn. I mean, they look awesome right now. The one, obviously, fly in the ointment is James Harden with that hamstring. But I still think it's... they just look really good right now. Obviously, I think some tactical things the Bucks are doing are playing into that. But even if Harden can't play until the finals, right? Even if he'd be out basically a month and then show up for the finals. Can Philadelphia beat this team?
I think they could. I think that, and now the Nets defense has surprised me, obviously, against the Bucks. But, I mean, you can't do anything with Joel Embiid. Like, they just are going to have to double team. They have no chance guarding him one-on-one at all. And, I mean, I think they probably won't play DeAndre. But, I mean, like, Nick Claxton, Blake Griffin, like, Clint Capella has no chance against Embiid. Like he is, as of right now. Now, maybe the Nets can do something different in terms of just perimeter pressure and prevent him from getting the ball and all that. But, he's going to cause problems for them. Now they can probably outscore him on the other end. I do think at this point, Philly, I like their defensive versatility probably better than Milwaukee. You know, Ben Simmons, I think, is probably better than anyone Milwaukee has on the perimeter.
I mean, he's an offensive liability, but my goodness, when he's out there as a secondary defender, like he hasn't been great when they put him on Trae Young, but when he's just kind of out there, like in another spot where he can just cause general havoc, like stuff just happens. Like, he's amazing.
You know, I think the Hawks need to do a better job at not guarding him, right? Like, for him to give up, you know, whatever it was, like a 130 defensive rating, and Matisse Thybulle plays 24 minutes and only has to take one three-pointer, like that means you're not doing a good enough job of not guarding him, if that's the case. Like, you got to just straight up let him bomb away, and because they have no chance of stopping them otherwise, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, they're basically in the same boat that the Nets would be next round, because Capella, as good as he is as a, you know, rim protector and doing some of the other things, like straight post-up defense against a behemoth center like Embiid is not his wheelhouse.
I think they should play him actually a lot less. I think you go all offense, because this, I used to go back to this with Shaq too, is like, why, if you're going to double team anyway, like what does it matter who the first guy is? Now Shaq, it mattered a little more because he was going to like post up right at the charge circle. Like, Embiid doesn't work that hard to get the ball because he's skilled enough that he can just back down or shoot over the top. He'll do all these other things as well. And frankly, he's probably not in the same condition that Shaq was at his peak to just work really hard around the basket. So I think if you're just going to double team anyway, why not go all offense and space Embiid out on the other end?
Would you start Gallinari at five? And then
I don't think I would start him, but I would bring him in pretty quickly. I actually thought he did the best of any of their guys guarding Embiid too, hilariously.
Well, I mean,
because he'll at least flop when he gets run over.
Yeah, he took that charge, and then there was the little fracas where I was worried Embiid was at risk of getting thrown out for that.
Who do you think wins? What do you think happens in that series? Before we're about to take some questions here, but you got any thoughts on how that plays out the rest of the way?
Yeah, I mean, I think Philadelphia's going to win the series, but Atlanta's a good enough team to extend them. Like, I think this. I said Philly in seven. I was a little more unsure about how much Embiid was going to be able to play when I wrote that. I would say probably, having seen these first two games, I'd go more six. But Atlanta's good. Like, they're a talented team. Defensively, they're not great. And so maybe your point about going all in on offense is just the way to go. And not having DeAndre Hunter, I think, hurt them, because now they're getting savaged by Tobias Harris in addition to Embiid. Like, there's two guys they can't guard.
I like the word savage. That's a good word. If you're hiring for your company, what you need is help making your short list of quality candidates. You don't need 500 candidates who just applied with no regard for what the actual qualifications are. You need Indeed instead. You can post, screen, and interview all on Indeed. You can also use skill tests to winnow down the field of applicants. And using Indeed overall will, on average, reduce the amount of time you spend on hiring by 27%. You only pay for the candidates that meet your must-have qualifications, and you can schedule and complete video interviews in your Indeed dashboard. They've got over 130 skills tests, or you can even add your own. According to Talent Nest, Indeed delivers 4 times more hires than all other job sites combined. So you're getting the high-quality candidates, you're saving time, and ultimately, getting the applicants that are right for you. Get started right now with a free $75 sponsored job credit to upgrade your job post at Indeed.com/locked, the name of this network. Get a $75 credit at Indeed.com/locked. Indeed.com/locked. Offer valid through June 30th. Terms and conditions apply. I'm going to tell you about Lucy Nicotine, a company founded by Caltech scientists and former smokers looking for a better and cleaner nicotine alternative. They've got both gums and lozenges in nice flavors, wintergreen, cinnamon, and pomegranate for their gum, cherry ice, citrus, and mint for the lozenge. Each has 4 milligrams of nicotine. And what's more, Lucy lozenges and gums are FSA and HSA eligible, so you can use your cards to purchase Lucy. It's convenient and discreet. You can enjoy it anywhere, on flights, at work, on the go, even in the gym. So it's 2021 now. You don't need to smoke cigarettes anymore. You can unplug your vape. You can throw out your dip. Get some Lucy nicotine gum or lozenges. A subscription comes directly to your door each month, so it's so simple. And you don't have to leave your house, because Lucy has their delivery down. And for Locked On NBA listeners, go to lucy.co and use the promo code LOCKEDONNBA to get 20% off all products on your first order, including gum or lozenges. That's lucy.co, promo code LOCKEDONNBA, the name of this network, at checkout. Also, I have to give this disclaimer. Warning, this product contains nicotine derived from tobacco. Nicotine is an addictive chemical. That's lucy.co, and be sure to use that promo code LOCKEDONNBA. Okay, well, let's get back in here to the speaker requests. And Hendrick, you are up first here. You don't have to ask if we can hear you. Just start talking, and we'll respond. Here we go. Hendrick, you are in. Hendrick is not in. The first, jump back in, Hendrick, if you have a chance. And let's get to Jaden. Jaden, you are on.
So I just kind of wanted to see your thoughts on the Jazz series and what the Jazz do with a couple things. I mean, first, just a pretty crazy game last night to see Mitchell go off. But my biggest concern is I feel like we really need to try to utilize Gobert more on the offensive end if we're going to win this series. I mean, if they're going to continue to play the switching defense for the majority of, the way they play us. I mean, I guess that's probably been the biggest issue with Gobert, and what a lot of people feel about him is he just doesn't have any much of an offensive game where he does much creation himself. And so I just wanted to kind of see, I mean, what your thoughts were and what maybe the Jazz could do to adjust and see if they can get Gobert more involved on the offensive end. And the another question I kind of want to ask too, since we're kind of on the topic of the Jazz as well, and you guys are more on the salary cap side of things. When this season concludes, I mean, they're going to be $130 million guaranteed, and that doesn't include Conley. I'd assume that they'd prioritize bringing Conley back. What do you think the Jazz could do if they were to try and dump Bogdanovich and his $19 million salary, you know, average for the next 2 years? See any possible fits where they could do that without taking any salary back? And would you consider him a positive asset given his shooting and, you know, any concerns with, you know, his defensive liabilities? So yeah, that's kind of my thoughts.
I'll take the Gobert part, John, if you want to talk about the tax one. I think the posting up, obviously, for Rudy is not, even as a duck-in guy, he's not really that strong. He's got a high center of gravity, and he has no touch around the basket. So I don't think giving him the ball, other than when he's open to dunk, is a great idea. But if you go back and watch the first play of the game against the Clippers, what they had him do is setting a quick screen, and then they shorted the pick and roll, and he sprinted to the front of the rim. And they when the you short the pick and roll, that means you basically you throw it to the wing, and then that guy tries to get it to the roll man because he has a better angle. And then they had to suck in the backside of the defense to deal with that, and they threw it to the weak side. They got a wide open three, which of course they missed because they couldn't hit anything at the beginning of the game. But that's really where he comes in, is just that hard sprint to the basket. He'll pick up a couple of fouls that way too on guys just holding him as they're trying to switch. So it's just those continuous hard rolls, slipping out of things. That's really where they can use him. And it's really more about his gravity than it's going to be, okay, we'll throw him the ball and let him do something. But John, yeah, you want to address kind of just their tax situation and Bogdanović?
Yeah. The other way Gobert can make them pay is by mashing these guys on the offensive boards when he gets a small on him. You saw him do that a little bit last night. I thought he could do it even a little more. With Bogdanović, are you starting Joe Ingles at the four then? Like, you need to fill in that spot sometime. I mean, this team is like, they're eight deep with quality, but then it drops off a cliff after that. So when you remove him, what are you doing for a starter? I think that's the one issue. Like, I don't see his contract as like a huge negative. I have a value on him as like 11 million-ish next year. And he's making 19, which is, you know, a little more. But it's not like dead money. I mean, they could trade it for something, clearly. But I think he actually fits what they do pretty well, because he's a great floor spacer, but he also, if you try to switch and put a small on him, he will mash that guy. And I think that's important with those guards Utah has, to that they have other ways to punish switches besides just Conley and Mitchell going one-on-one. So I do think he plays a pretty useful role for them. I think if they were going to try to trade somebody to move off of money, it actually might be Ingles, as odd as that says, sounds, because he makes 13 next year and he's in the last year of his deal. But they have some hard financial decisions, especially in that market. If you think Conley's going to get 20 to 30 million, I mean, that you're deep in the tax now. You don't want to move off of O'Neal necessarily. I mean, do you trade Favors and then hope that Udoka Azubuike can become a legitimate center, or you draft another center with your 30th pick? Like, they got some tough decisions coming up, clearly.
Appreciate it.
All right, let's get back to the speaker request here. Let's get Alan in here. Alan Cockrell, you are on. I love seeing all the avatars of everyone's pets. That's always an enjoyable part of this. Alan, you there? All right, maybe he's just a dog and he can't talk because that's what his avatar is. Jump back in, Alan, if you get a chance. I know you've been active in the comments, so we'd love to hear from you. All right, here we go. Let's get Don in. Don has a problem with something that I tweeted last night. Let's see what that is. Don, you are on.
I wanted to hear a good explanation for it. Maybe I'm reading it wrong, but it sounds like the Hawks should keep their starters in to put more mileage on Embiid's knee to maybe, you know, increase the risk of injury. That's how I interpreted it.
Well, so this was at the end of the game. Normally, I'd be saying, hey, the game's over. Get your starters out of there and just wait to play for the next game. But by keeping your starters out there, the custom in the NBA is that as long as the team that's down keeps their starters out there, the team that's ahead keeps their starters out there. So if you're the Hawks, the way that this injury works for Embiid is he's got this meniscus, he's trying to play on it. The more wear and tear you have on it, yeah, you probably increase the odds of it swelling up and him either not being able to play as effectively or missing a game later in the series. Like, it's the type of thing, if you have that meniscus issue, they're trying to manage the swelling, and just the more mileage you put on it, maybe the less effective he'll be later in the series. I don't think that's any different than, you know, a guy who's prone to getting tired, putting some more mileage on him. So I think in that case, it was the right strategy. I don't know that they were thinking that, to leave their starters out for longer so Embiid would get more minutes and potentially be less effective later in the series. That's not rooting for Joel Embiid to get injured. I really celebrate what he's done this year. He was my per minute MVP this season. But the reality is, if you're trying to win the series, you absolutely need to have in mind that, you know, he's injured, and you don't try to injure him, but make him run up and down the floor, make some more moves, make some more jumps. Like, absolutely, you should try to do that.
I would say tactically, I mean, that's fair game. Yeah.
It's a good strategy. I agree with the strategy. I just think the tweet itself is in bad taste. And maybe clarifying it would have helped.
First of all, like a tweet, you can only say so much within the number of characters that there are. I mean, you know, if people are going to interpret that as like.
True, but there's also.
I'm sorry?
There's also threats. Like, you could. make another one right below it. I don't really think that's an excuse.
Well, okay. So, like, number one, like, Twitter is, I mean, an excuse for what? Like, it's in bad taste how? Like, that I want him to get injured? Like, this is sports. This is strategy. Like,
it's literally saying that the Hawks should play their players extra minutes to increase the risk of injury on a beat. That's what it said.
Okay. So, what's wrong with that?
That's not good taste at all.
Like, it's true, though. I mean, right? Like, if you were the coach of the Hawks, would you do that or not? You would do it, right? If you're the coach of the Hawks.
Increase the risk of another player's injury? No, I would not want to increase the risk of MB's injury.
I mean, we're not talking about them like trying to like knock the guy out of the air and play dirty or something. It's just make him run up and down the floor more, like make him play the game of basketball for longer.
Poor taste. I mean, this is poor taste. I know I'm not the only one who thinks.
Oh, no, you're not. I know. I'm sure you've seen the quote. Every other Philly fan does, it seems like, getting a lot of crap for that. But I mean, that's just, it's just the reality of the situation, you know? Like, so. I mean,
I don't even like it,
John. As a general, somewhat neutral party here, do you think that's just like a terrible thing to tweet?
I mean, this is what you're thinking if you're working for one of the teams. If you're Atlanta, you're not thinking, I hope Embiid gets injured, but you are thinking we are going to try to tax him physically as much as we can to gain an advantage, and that's just what you do in that situation. So that's the reality of it.
Yeah. So I mean,
I don't know. I think it could have been misinterpreted.
Well, okay. I'm not responsible for misinterpretations like that. That's the reality of the situation. That's like what people on the other team are thinking. That's what you come to this account and this show for. I mean, I think the people who are complaining about that is like in poor taste. I'm not saying I hope Joel Embiid gets injured as a fan. I'm trying to look at it from the Hawks perspective. And if you can't handle that, like, I think you're just soft, honestly.
Oh my God. Listen, it's not that big of a deal to me. I'm just saying it's poor taste.
Okay. Well, I mean, so if I should have said, I hope he doesn't get injured, but they should do
and
this.
And I know
something.
It's not your first tweet in poor taste either. I know.
Yeah. All right. Well, I appreciate that. And, you know, I'm always willing to have a civil discussion with people.
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing me up.
What'd you say?
I said, I appreciate you bringing me up.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I'm always willing to be accountable and talk about the stuff I do, but I also am going to defend it when I think that's necessary. Okay. We're going to get a couple more in here. Let's get Chet in here. Chet, what's going on, man? How are you?
Good. I just want to say about the last caller situation, you were totally in the right there. I mean, I'm a Lakers fan, and the Suns went right at AD every play, and I thought it was 100% the right move, and there was no hard feelings. So, I mean, I don't totally understand where he was coming from, but whatever. My real question is about the heliocentric offices and Doncic, because it seems like the best way to like unlock some of these superstars so that they can compete in the playoffs and play all these possessions is to have some other superstar or someone who can carry the offense when they're on the court a little bit, you know, for a little bit of rest, and when he's off the court. And it was interesting to see that he had the ball like 13% of the time, and the next highest in the playoffs was like 9.5%. So his numbers in the third and fourth quarter are obviously going to be down because he's gassed, you know? I truly think he is the best player in the world, because if you put him, let's say you switch Kawhi and Luka, I know this isn't the best way to determine if someone's like a better player, but I think that the Clippers would coast through the West. And I want to know what your thoughts are on that.
John, go ahead.
I think, you know, there's the other end of the floor too, though, right? I mean, like, Kawhi just unlocks so much more capability defensively when he can switch onto your five capably and still guard your 1-2-3 on the perimeter. So I mean, Luka's awesome, but like, I'm still taking Kawhi if there's a game tomorrow.
Yeah, and Kawhi was scoring 45 points and also guarding Luka, and he didn't wear down. You know, I think there is a certain guys do have the capability of running a little bit harder now. Luka having to beat his guy off a switch every single time and stuff, you know, that is more difficult to be the only guy. Like, he's not able to take possessions off an offense. So I definitely feel it, Chet, that having another guy who could be a threat, and, you know, they envisioned Porzingis being that guy, but unfortunately he's just not able to really be any kind of a creator for them, and Brunson wasn't effective. So yeah, I mean, that it's an issue. I, you know, Luka is like a pretty good shooter, so he could play off the ball more. You know, they need to explore more of that for sure. But I also, you know, I'm not willing to go there yet with Luka, you know, particularly because he, you know, he got lit up by Kawhi at the end of game six trying to switch as well. So your defensive versatility is a little bit less. I think Luka's okay on switches, not amazing. So yeah, I think I probably would rather have Kawhi or KD just because they don't have any weaknesses to attack, whereas Luka has some. Even if he might be a more all-encompassing offensive player overall.
Yeah, I want to say that I had similar thoughts about Luka and defense before. I mean, he's gotten a lot better. He's
pretty
much average. And because he's like, you know, he's 6'7 or whatever, it's not the same thing as like these smaller guards switching on. If they're like a liability at all, it's done, you know, in the playoffs.
He at least competes. Like, he's not going to just get trucked for a great shot every single time. I agree with you on
that. Yeah, exactly. And I don't know. I mean, the Kawhi thing with him dropping 45, you know, he's not taking it on as many shots, not creating as much. There's all this, you don't even know. Like, if you watch a random Clipper game, you don't necessarily even know Kawhi is the best player on the team. It could be someone else or whatever, Paul George going off or whatever, because that kind of shows that they can rely on Paul George to create the offense when he's off the floor. That Harden and Chris Paul way of dealing with the heliocentric offense, it wasn't really heliocentric because they would just have Chris Paul run the heliocentric part when he was off the floor. But when he was on the floor, it gave Harden a little bit more rest, take some possessions off, and they almost beat the Warriors. So just putting like those two like creators around shooting seems to be like the key, especially with how the Nets are right now. Like, without even Harden, doesn't really matter because they have two guys who can take over when the others, you know, a little bit tired or whatever, and they can spray around to shooting. And that seems like that's the future of the NBA.
No, it is good to have three all-time Hall of Famers on your team. I do agree with you there. All right, thanks, Chet. Always enjoy hearing from you. Let's get one more in here, and that is going to be Joe. Joe, how are you? Joe Rise, are you here?
Hey there.
Hey, Joe.
How are you?
Doing great. This is our last one, so what do you got for us?
Oh, all right. Well, it wasn't even as much of an analysis question, but I was kind of curious as to who you guys are rooting for to make it into the Western Conference Finals, just from a matchup perspective. I know we've talked a lot about wanting to see the Bucks and Nets play because they match up very interestingly. Hasn't been that way so far, but just who what are the two teams you guys would want to see and why?
I want to see Denver play Utah again, selfishly, just because of what happened in last year's playoffs. But I want to see Gobert and Jokic play against each other again. So that's the matchup I would like to see. I don't think I'm going to get it. I think Phoenix is going to win that series. And then I want to see Mike Conley win a championship. So I want Utah there for that reason too.
I'd say Utah Phoenix might be the most, I mean, definitely Phoenix. I think just because Denver is so limited with their perimeter rotation that I think they're not like a huge threat. Although I had them losing these two series too. I've always been maybe too low on Denver. We'll see how game two goes tonight. But yeah, I think Utah Phoenix or Clippers Phoenix are both right up there for me. I think Utah Phoenix, just because I think that would be just a very fascinating dance of how each team is going to deal with the other's pick and roll when neither team really has, you know, the versatility to switch. So you've got like traditional centers out there. I think it would be a fascinating matchup, like just an unbelievable backcourt matchup as well. So that's probably what I would be looking for. And thanks for that question, Joe. Awesome to hear from all of you again. And John and I will be back next week at the same usual time, 2 Eastern, 11 Pacific. Talk to you all then.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Save big money on your entire roofing project now at Menards. Protect your home for years to come with Owens Corning architectural shingles. They offer long-lasting performance while providing ultimate protection with a 130 miles per hour wind rating and limited lifetime warranty. Choose from over 50 options of Owens Corning shingles in-store and on Menards.com. And check out more of our great deals going on now.